Woman Jack listeners, we hope everyone is doing well and staying safe. Planners Under the Influence has managed to record another episode in times of COVID-19. Speaking of which, how do you guys feel with going back to the new normal? I believe it's time to start thinking our purpose. The field of design and health, previously the purview of healthcare design professionals, has reached a new turning point where health impacts are becoming a focal point and designing environments of all scales. We urban planners need to address the new directions of our series that put first and foremost health and equity. Alan Betrat said it best. Overall, new urban planners, and more specifically mayors, should be very good janitors. Not an inspired genius, but just a good janitor. He said this by explaining that the problem with planners is that they try to plan what is happening with your lot, and they do not plan enough for what will happen to the public realm and what will serve what is being developed within the land. Typically, you have the mayor of any city saying to the press that he or she will be controlling the height of each building, the amount of floor space everybody consumes, and their income. And at the time, he doesn't even pay attention to the garbage bags which accumulate on the sidewalk in the evening and obstruct the sidewalk there. So we strongly believe in Planners Under the Influence that this is our time to be really good janitors. So, for this episode, we have the pleasure to sit down with Lucien Leharlick from Neighborlytics to talk more about the social analytics platform and what is to collect data for human-centered cities. She shared with us good insight about the importance of being an urban planner in these pandemic times. So, pick up a drink and let's talk cities. Also, this is a very special podcast. It's Mother's Day, so happy Mother's Day to all. And Feliz Dia Ma. Welcome back to another episode here in Planners Under the Influence. Today we have the pleasure to talk to Lucien Leharlick about what happens when we combine cutting-edge data science with best practices in urban design. Lucien is an urban designer, city expert, co-founder, chief growth officer of Neighborlytics, and the list of titles goes on and on. So welcome, Lucien, and thanks for making time for us.
Thanks, Diego. It's nice to chat.
Okay, so let's go directly to it. So Neighborlytics is perhaps one of the fastest growing urban tech companies right now here in Australia. Congratulations on that. And
thanks.
With your vast experience in placemaking, when was the time that you guys clicked and you decided to focus on data? Or what particular time you decided we should focus on this?
Yeah, that's a good question. And you know, if you'd asked me 3 or 4 years ago if I thought I would be running a data analytics company, I might have thought that was kind of a crazy idea. But I've actually been interested in the idea of measuring cities for a long time. And I think, yeah, as you said, I've been working in placemaking for more than a decade and really focused particularly on how we shape our planning systems, our placemaking systems to deliver on human outcomes. How do we make places really better for people? And one of the things that we realized when we really started to look into this problem is that you can only really manage what you can measure. So when I was working on placemaking projects, we were trying to work out ways of quantifying the value of what was created. Because often in placemaking, the real benefit that you create isn't the parklet or the pop-up, it's the new social networks, it's the businesses that are improved, it's the way that neighbors who didn't know each other before and started to know each other. So all of this value was created, but it was very difficult value to measure. It was like social value and cultural value. And you know, when we looked at what city makers were measuring, you know, city makers are measuring traffic, they're measuring the numbers of buildings that are created, they're measuring air quality, they're measuring the meters squared of pavement that gets constructed, and all of these things are important to measure, but we tend to put emphasis on improving the things that we measure. And so we started to look into how we could quantify value, and a lot of the methods for quantifying the human stuff, you know, this social, this sort of messy social cultural stuff, were quite difficult to scale. Like if you do interviews or observations or look at demographic information like the census, those data types are really good for projects because you can do it once. But if you want to do this for a whole neighborhood, a whole city, and you want to do it every month, you just never have the resources to be able to invest in that kind of data collection. And so we started to look at other methods that we could use to start to quantify the value of our cities. Now, in this day and age, our cities generate enormous amounts of data every day. And it's often behavioral human data about where we go and what we value and what we engage with. And so Neighbolytics was really built off the idea that if we could measure what really matters about cities, so if we could, instead of measuring traffic and building heights, if we could measure quality of life and well-being, then we would be able to actually steer our whole industry to be able to focus on what really matters as outcomes. And it turns out that you can actually harvest this really diverse, rich and dynamic data set of digital data to quantify these metrics. So I guess it was a long journey to think about how we started to quantify value. And then we've built that into a digital analytics product. And now we're measuring cities in 12 countries. So that's pretty exciting.
Well, that's amazing. I mean, the expansion of, I guess, Neighbolytics have been really interesting. And as you said, you just mentioned something that we just learned in another podcast. We were talking to Be the Guys Korda, and she's told us what gets measures gets done. And I guess it's really something to take into it, because there's how many data we can collect each day at each time. So the way to process it, it's basically, and how to process it and how to present it may have a real impact or really will affect our future decisions.
Right. And actually planners on the whole are not very good at understanding what's actually happening in cities. I mean, we know why, so we have best practice case studies of why some places are successful and why others are struggling. But if you had to really pinpoint exactly what were the mechanisms and drivers of that success, very few people could really tell you, because it's often sort of more anecdotal information that we have. And so by being able to quantify what success looks like, it helps us to understand what the levers are, and therefore we can make better and more practical decisions.
So can we just go back to what you've just said right now? Will you say that is the main, it's an issue about urban planners, or will you say it's a trait that we should be learning?
Yeah, I think urban planners are quite good at making evidence-based decisions, but the reality is that we haven't until recently had the capacity to measure some of the factors which are really important for neighborhood success. So we've had this kind of physical data for quite a long time, and we do traffic studies and other things like that. But to Billy Giles Corti's point, and I follow and know her work very well. Like what gets done. What gets measured is what gets prioritized. Mm-hmm. And if we make decisions without understanding the full story, then it's easy for us to not necessarily lead to the right outcomes. So yeah, we believe that this is a really core missing piece of the puzzle. And so I don't think planners are getting it wrong. I just think they haven't had the information, because if you think about trying to collect information about behavior and lifestyle for like a whole population, so for like the whole of Melbourne, and you think about doing that manually, I mean, where would you even start? Like it's so difficult to think that how you could ask enough people or observe enough people. But we can do it through the digital record, because people are contributing these footprints about their behavior and lifestyle every day through their smartphones. And that really helps understand how cities work.
Okay. So, is as a social analytic platform for neighborhoods, right? You guys measure that well-being, the quality of life in those neighborhoods. So based on that digital footprint, so under the conditions that we're living right now, which are lockdowns or partial lockdowns, depending on the place, what has been the challenge? Or like, is less data coming in? How are you guys approaching to this situation?
Yeah, I would actually say there's even more data than before. Because
Really?
in many ways, the interactions that perhaps previously some of them were online, now almost all of them are online. And if we want to take the way that we look, the way that we understand data is not personal data. We don't look at any personal information.
Mm-hmm.
What we look at is location information that gives us evidence of how a place functions. So what are the activities that are happening in the park? What kind of community groups exist? What places are popular? Mm-hmm. Where do people spend time? This kind of information, which gives us these insights into behavior. Now, so the behavior has shifted dramatically,
exactly.
But we can see that shift in the digital data. So imagine before, if we're looking at a main street, previously people might have been highly engaged with activities like eating outdoors,
mm-hmm.
Like socializing with friends, like events and activities. Now we are seeing that those same neighborhoods still have the same volume of data, if not more, but the activities are indoors. So we're seeing people are exercising indoors, that they are socializing with friends from a distance. And so that we understand these kind of behavioral shifts, which we are all experiencing, but it's very interesting to quantify them at a population level and understand what's really going on. And we did this similarly during the bushfires. We did a study with the Australian Financial Review looking at comparing data from October to January and looking at the impacts on lifestyle and behaviour, and found things like, and I don't have the study in front of me, but, you know, there was a 200% increase in exercising indoors, and there was a 40% decrease in dining out, and there was a, you know, 700% or something increase in people talking about weather, which is not surprising.
Yeah.
By quantifying these lifestyle and behavioral shifts, you know, during a time like COVID, that's really important, because that gives us clues as to how we're going to start to respond.
Yeah.
If we're starting to plan for response efforts without understanding what's actually going on, then in many ways we're flying blind. And one of the things that we're particularly interested in is looking at resilience. And, you know, resilience comes in lots of flavors. It comes in the resilience and diversity of the local economy. It comes in understanding what kinds of physical assets we have access to. You know, do we have a 20-minute neighborhood and access to everything we need in walking distance? Do we have social relationships and connections locally that we can access? All of these measures can be measured in the digital data. So if we start to look at the pre-COVID-19 situation and understanding where the pockets of resilience are, where the weaknesses are, then how that transitions, you know, how those places are performed during this moment, it starts to give us clues of what kind of support is needed. Like, do local businesses need support for digital literacy because they don't have a large digital footprint? Do certain communities have lower levels of social connection normally, like before pre-COVID, and perhaps a way to support them through this period might be to offer strategies for improving social connection. So we're not seeing less data, but we are certainly seeing that the behavior and lifestyle is shifting.
One of the interesting things about that is that you guys must have a lot of information about people occupying the space itself. Right now, I guess it's shifted into, you know, parks. There's, especially here in Australia, because you're able to at least go to the park to take a walk, to have, able to, you know, to just have a physical activity. But in another sense, let's talk about, let's say, our social infrastructure, which is basically right now is kind of empty. In the future, Ailey, how will you manage this? Will this be, because is this a starting point of creating something new, or this will be a huge, huge outlier?
I think the digital record, any data collected right now, I expect will be an outlier right now compared to everything else that's been normal before.
Yeah.
But I, you know, people are talking a lot about a new normal, and I am sure that this is changing our worldview in so many ways, and ways that we probably can't even predict yet. But I think that we are starting to engage with places digitally more than we ever did before. So, you know, examples of that is like maybe you used to visit your favorite cafe down the road. Now you order takeaway online from them and you're still interacting with them. You're still engaging with them, but the way that you're doing that is different. And you will probably choose to opt in and order from and visit and engage with places that you like or follow or have, you know, some affinity with whatever lifestyle, if you want to call it that. So there are certain places that you will choose to order from and others because you want to support both the local businesses, and there are other places that you might look over. So businesses that are going to be successful in this time are ones that are going to really intentionally look at engagement as a success criteria, rather than just, you know, how much money they make. Engagement's becoming really important.
So, Logan, this is pretty interesting now that we're talking into this new normal, but in February 2020, I went and looked up a little bit of the blog, and this was really interesting because this was pre-pandemic times. You wrote an article saying that 2020 is going to be the year for city makers to step up and do things differently, right?
Right.
You were, I don't know if you were foreseeing the future or you were, I don't know what happened, but I would like to think, I mean, that is a hugely relevant comment for now. Yeah. It is more than ever, given the situation. And how can we be smarter right now? Are we seeing good examples already happening? Can you tell us something about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're seeing great examples. The shift that I've noticed is that previously, you know, urban planners and city makers, we care about cities passionately and we talk about it a lot. But my friends and family and others, they're not really so interested until now. And now everybody is talking about their neighborhood because we are in a lifestyle where we have a total relationship with our neighborhood because we are all living locally. And everyone is talking about cities because the way that the pandemic is spreading and playing out is very much related to our built environment and our connection paths. And so everyone's interested in cities now. And that's actually something that we couldn't have foreseen. This whole conversation has shifted towards an urban conversation. But yeah, I think city makers have a responsibility now more than ever to step up. In many ways, a lot of the answers we already have, and it now could be a time to implement. And the sort of examples that we're seeing with, you know, New York City is laying out, I forget how many hundreds of miles of pedestrian streets. We're seeing Milan is going car-free. We're seeing these bold steps. You know, sometimes it takes a massive disruption of behavior in order for us to, you know, make a big change. And I think city makers for years have been advocating for more pedestrian-oriented cities, for less car congestion. And now we are almost overnight seeing these policies put forward that enable, you know, cars to be removed from our cities, for public spaces to be reinstated or activated in ways that enable people to go outside and be safe with social distancing. And so this is, I think we're seeing some great and I hope long-term steps in people's mindset shifts, because we've always known it's a good idea to be more pedestrian-oriented, but it's equally always been in the too hard basket, or maybe one day and maybe it'll be too hard. But now, like, we have no choice. It's really forcing people to change, but it's a real opportunity for city makers to step up and lead and have a voice in that conversation.
Talking in particular about Melbourne, will you want something specific to happen? Are you seeing already a change or no?
A couple of things I hope happen here. I'm not front and center of the conversation, but I know there has been a movement for a long time to see Melbourne CBD go car free. And it is close to car free, not car free, but it's car less, you know, compared to how it was a month ago. And if ever we wanted a case study of what the city, how the city functions without cars, it's now. So I'm hoping that Melbourne can follow suit of Milan and New York, and even to some extent Sydney, look at models of reducing, vehicle traffic in the CBD. I think that would be a fantastic long-term outcome. But the other outcome that I think we're going to see is a real focus on resilience. Yeah. So, you know, resilience has been there as a conversation, and it's been not in the background, but kind of seen as a nice to have mm-hmm. for a long time, that, you know, you do what's necessary and then you think about resilience afterwards. But now what we're seeing is that the neighborhoods, particularly the planned communities and other urban renewal projects, have intentionally focused on resilience by building infrastructure early, by fostering social connection, by putting in bike paths and other things like early. They are now reaping the benefits of that, because you don't plan for resilience for good times, you plan for resilience for bad times. Mm-hmm. And we've had, you know, we've been in a state of emergency like almost continuously since November in Australia with the bushfires and now the pandemic. So we are seeing that this is why we plan for resilience. And so I think rather than that being a considered something that's nice to have, or if we had time or if we had more money, it's now going to be sort of a mandatory focus. Because we know that if we don't do that, it costs us so much in these times, because yeah. we have, you know, this crisis of social connection or lack of access to support.
I think it's pretty interesting what you said about it's going to cost us more later, of course. And now that we are in a crisis, we really have to focus ourselves or where, like each dollar where we spend it. And how much right. and how much of a return can we take of that? Because people will be concerned of the economical impact too. And yeah, if we talk better. About and if we talk about pedestrianizers, you know, it's you we have to be able to communicate well to people how the advantage of pedestrianized streets into the retail, one of the hardest hit sectors or industry. And that is something that we need to be able to, especially like, let's say, I'm calling myself a city maker, even though I haven't worked right now as a city maker, but That's what we have to be able to communicate. I'm really interested right now with all this that we are dealing with, all digital platforms. We're online most of the time. Do you think that the concept of the smart city will pick up? Do you think it will be different?
Yeah, actually, I do. I do for a lot of reasons. But the main one that we've observed in our work at Neighbourlytics is... I would say, while I mentioned before that planners are quite evidence-based, they mm-hmm. are quite illiterate in data, my experience is. And I say that as an urban planner who's recently, studied a lot and learned a lot about data analytics. And, you know, we have a lot of hesitation to really look at data because we are so used to looking at other evidence like case studies and best practices. And the shift that we are seeing is that we've, in our industry, we have a lot of data skeptics, and mm-hmm. it's always good to be skeptical. We should always be asking questions. But now the conversation has shifted from, I'm not sure about your data, to, can you give me all your data right now? And everyone wants to know what's going on. And I think because we are starting to engage more fully digitally, we are seeing that the divide between like our physical and digital is kind of dissolving. Mm-hmm. And actually the future that I see is not that we have one that is physical or digital, which is where it's kind of been to date. It's been like you're either in the physical camp or you're in the digital camp. Mm-hmm. I actually think that the physical and digital are now completely merging in our experience mm-hmm. and that they are becoming one and the same conversation. And I do think that we will become, you know, building back digital. Some people are talking about building black place-led. But I think data, technology, and places are going to be the critical success factor in how we build back successfully after this.
Yeah, well, look, it sounds like we have a great window of opportunity. Exactly, for all of us to actually make things happen. I have to say, I'm a little bit scared that we are all trying to get back into this normal. Hopefully it's a new normal. It's not going to be like, you know, our old business as usual. Thank you. As you know, this is a podcast that we want to share, also experience and maybe share your journey. But given right now that you changed already many urban designer, placemaking, entrepreneur, data right now, being someone who, what would you say, what would be the best advice that you will say to like a recent graduate or even someone that is looking to study urban planning?
I would like to
have your input in that sense, because this is a personal story, but sometimes I do wanted to study urban planning, but maybe I felt that everything changed so quickly, and even in 2 years there are a set of hard skills that we probably wanted to have. Maybe as we go on we can learn, of course we can learn those traits as we get experience in the field. But what would you say, what would you recommend someone to, you should focus and you should focus on this?
Yeah, it's a hard question, but I think now is a fantastic time to be studying urban planning. Now is a fantastic time to be a city maker, and for a couple of reasons. One is that in the next 30 years, we need to build about as much city as we've ever built before. The population of the world is urbanizing. So 80% of the world's going to live in cities by 2050. If we continue business as usual city planning without city makers, which is kind of what's happening around the world, we're going to end up with cities which deliver really, really poor outcomes for people. And it's almost this call to action that we can't let that happen. Mm-hmm. but I think the practice of urban planning will shift dramatically. It is already shifting, but I think it's one of the industries that is going to be massively disrupted by technology, and also as many different industries are. But I think the principles of city making are still really important. So I would encourage people to learn less about... I might get in trouble here, but less about legislation and less about the practice of planning, consulting and perhaps more statutory planning, and learn more about the principles of planning, because the things that make great cities are kind of universal to how we've always made cities. They have different cultural expressions, they have different sizes and different formats, but being able to live and work and connect and good life outcomes in a neighborhood has something that's existed for many, many hundreds of years. Mm-hmm. And understanding more and more how we go about creating those kinds of places and where the best practices are and what the great planning principles are, we need more of that. But we don't necessarily need everyone who knows that to be an urban planner. And I think what I found really powerful in what we're doing now is combining urban planning and urban design with technology. Yeah. And, we also need city makers. We need to make sure that people who are designing cities aren't only using data, but they're also informed by really great city making practices. So we need city makers in lots of different spheres. We need them in policy. We need people who are making decisions about transport and things to have been, in politics, to have been informed by good practices of city making. Mm-hmm. So I would think as a profession, it's likely to go through quite a lot of disruption. And so we should expect that. Mm-hmm. But the skills that you have as an urban planner, I think, will be universal throughout. And if I think in my, the reason that I guess I have applied that myself in many different arenas. So, I originally studied landscape architecture and urban design, but I quite early in my career started working for the United Nations in Southeast Asia. Now, there was no role for an urban planner in that organization, but I knew that someone with city making skills was needed to create the outcomes that we needed. We were working on slum resettlement projects. And so in slum resettlement projects, good city making principles are really important for creating good neighborhoods, but no one was looking for an urban planner. They just needed a city, someone who could think that way. And then again, when we started Co-Design Studio, my previous company, we were looking at placemaking, and that was at 10 years ago, when nobody was talking about placemaking. Now, we weren't necessarily thinking about urban planning typically. We were thinking about how we created really good outcomes for communities, but we needed city-making thinking. And now in data analytics, we're thinking about how do we make sure that cities are not algorithms, cities are not a data equation, cities are for people, but we actually need data to support that. So if that makes sense, I think that there is a real role to be able to, for graduates now, to focus on that bigger picture of learning as much as we can and continually staying on top of best practices around the world of how people are shaping cities, but not getting fixated on particular types of jobs, because those will be disrupted.
Okay. Yeah, no, it sounded perfect. Well, look, we're conscious of times, and we have two things that we wanted also to discuss with you, but this is a really, we want to know who is on the personal side, who is Lucinda Hartley, in small summary, outside of Neighbourlytics. Yeah, what do you do? Just give us a brief.
Outside of Neighbourlytics?
Yeah.
Outside of work, I don't do that much. I mean, these days, I just work all the time. That's really sad, isn't it? No, but I am, the things that I'm, you know, I'm actually like a true urbanist in that most of what I do in my free time is like reading about cities as well as during my work.
As we all of the, yeah.
Yeah, but look, I personally, the things that really keep me motivated is that I love running. I'm a runner. I ran my first marathon last year, but I've always been doing athletics or running in some form. And partly that gives me a sort of mental break during the week to run. It gives me some goals to focus on and some social time as well, because I tend to usually, not right now, but I usually run with friends. Now I run with my podcast. Maybe I'll listen to some more of your podcasts.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Yeah, and before I had children, I used to also like creative activities, like, you know, drawing and painting and things like that, but now I'm mostly running after them if I have free time, so that's fun too.
Well, thank you. And also, of course, now that you mention, and we have to ask you, you have to give us your book recommendation.
So I saw that. I, you know, one confession that I have to make is that I'm not a big reader. Like I read a lot of blogs and news articles, but yeah. I don't read a lot of books. I think last year I read 2 books in the whole year.
Yeah.
It's embarrassing. So I set myself a goal this year that I needed to read 1 book every month.
Hey. This is.
Yeah.
We have the same.
We have the same. Yeah. Goal.
This
yeah,
is
one
every
month.
This is yeah. This is one in three. Yeah. Exactly. It's been a little bit tough. Sometimes I pick up after the 3rd week and I was like, shit, I should just...
Yeah, I've got to finish it.
Yeah. But it's actually pushing me to read more. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. It's making me find time when maybe I would otherwise just scroll and read news. I will pick up a book. And I'm really enjoying that. I like reading business books. Like, I'm an entrepreneur and I like to read books about business and startups and things like that. And so this year I have just finished reading 2 books. One is Traction by Gino Wickman, which is about operational strategies for startups.
Wow, okay.
It's kind of like your operational plan. I really enjoyed it. It was very practical about organizing teams, accountabilities, scalability. It was basically about putting everything that you need in to gain traction and growth and high growth companies. So that was a really great book, and we're implementing some of those principles now at Neighbourlytics. And I also finished reading Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman. And I have previously read a summary of that. That's the other trick. I read 15-minute summaries of books quite often, but this year I'm not cheating. I'm trying to read the whole book. But Thinking Fast and Slow, I think, is a particularly relevant concept and book for this time. Because it's about, we have our best thinking when we, like, you know, we have big ideas, but then we also need to think sort of slowly and procedurally as well. And I tend to think fast all the time. And so this, you know, we're in a time, I think we're in a season of rest. We're in a season of slowing down for a lot of the world. And so this idea of thinking fast and slow is actually more relevant now than ever. As I think we've been in a thinking really fast for a long time, and now we're being, you know, cause to step back and reflect and be more analytical and more procedural. Wow. So those are 2 that I would recommend, Traction and Thinking Fast and Slow.
Well, thank you very much. And you know, you're not the first one who actually runs a company and have recommended a book entirely outside of urban planning, and how reading something outside maybe cities and planning has actually helped them to achieve a completely different goal. Which I completely understand, and thank you. I guess it's another one, so thank you for that. Well, Lucinda, thank you so much for making the time to record an episode with us. Really,
yeah, my pleasure.
We hope that we can properly meet face to face soon in the coming future.
Yeah, and, maybe in Quito.
Yeah, maybe in Quito. You know, you've already been there. You now have a house, so when we can collaborate in any way we can. thank you for sharing all your experience and your stories, and we will talk soon.
Yeah, great. Thanks so much for having me.
Don't worry.
I really enjoyed it.